On About Books, we delve into the latest news about the publishing industry with interesting insider interviews with publishing industry experts. We'll also give you updates on current nonfiction authors and books, the latest book reviews, and we'll talk about the current nonfiction books featured on C-SPAN's Book TV. And welcome to About Books. Now, in a few minutes, we'll chat with the former CEO of Macmillan Publishing, who spent 40 years in the industry and came out with stories to tell. But first, here's some of the latest news from the publishing world. Well, the end of 2023 saw a shakeup in the world of independent book publishing. Skyhorse is buying the Regnery imprint. Regnery is known for its conservative voices, including Dennis Prager, Ann Coulter, Republican Senators Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz. It goes all the way back generations to William F. Buckley. David Evans, the chief operating officer of Salem, which is selling Regnery, said in a statement that the company is, quote, thrilled to pass the torch of the oldest and most respected conservative publishing company in America to Skyhorse Publishing. In writing about the merger, Michael Schaub of Kirkus Reviews called Skyhorse, quote, one of the nation's most controversial publishers. He added that Skyhorse has a reputation for picking up books that other publishers either dropped or passed on, including books by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Woody Allen, Garrison Keillor, Norman Mailer, and others. And in other news, just in time for the beginning of the presidential primary season, NBC News' Matt Dixon will release his new book, which is a look at the political and personal relationship between Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former President Donald Trump. Mr. Dixon, who spent some time in Florida as the bureau chief for Politico, has titled his debut book, Swamp Monsters, Trump versus DeSantis. The publication date, January 9th. Publishers Weekly describes the book as a, quote, rollicking study of cutthroat Republican politics. And beginning now on About Books, an interview with John Sargent. Mr. Sargent is the former CEO of Macmillan Publishers and the author of this new book, Turning Pages, The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher. Book TV's John McArdle sat down with him recently to talk about his memoir about four decades in the publishing industry.
And joining us now in About Books, it's John Sargent. He worked at six different publishing companies over a 40-year career, and he compiled the best stories from that career in his book, Turning Pages, The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher. Mr. Sargent, one of those stories is about what you call the best book never published. What was A Cold Eye for the Horseman?
We had bought the rights at St. Martin's Press before I arrived there. We had bought the rights to a sequel of For Gone with the Wind. And, you know, it was a struggle. We found someone to write it. It didn't work. And then out of the blue, Pat Conroy, who was this, you know, fantastic Southern writer, wrote me this letter that, you know, he wanted to write the sequel to Gone with the Wind. And this is a guy who's written, you know, The Great Santini, various very powerful books that turned into big movies, and he's an extraordinary writer. And Gone with the Wind was sort of the center point of his entire growing up. You know, his mom read it to him. It was his mother's favorite book. And he wrote me this three-page letter that was just, you know, utterly fantastic. And his idea was to retell the story of Gone with the Wind from in the first person, from Rhett Butler's point of view. And the deal fell apart with the estate, Margaret Mitchell estate. The book never got written. But I tell you, it's one of the few times I actually had the hair stand up on the back of my neck when I was reading his extraordinarily eloquent and impassioned description of what he was going to write.
And where were you working at the time? And when about was that?
I had just started at St. Martin's Press. So that would have been 28 years ago.
And before that, you were working on children's books. Most parents familiar with the book, probably Chicka Chicka Boom Boom. You describe it as one of the books you're proudest of in your long publishing career. Why?
So one, it was the way I sort of thought of that was the books I'm proudest of are books that I had something to do with their success personally. And they have to be books that reach a large, large audience and books that were financially successful. And they have to be somehow a magical book, you know, and they have to move people. And that book, when I talk to people today, if I interview a room, I do the math. If the kids are, or the people in the room are in their 20s, I ask if they learned their ABCs from Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, and almost everybody raises their hand. It was a remarkable book from when we first saw it, when it first came in. We knew it was remarkable, and we couldn't get people. It was different from anything that had ever been done before, and we couldn't get people as excited about it as we were. And at the end of the day, the marketing director and I agreed that we would just grow beards and we wouldn't shave them until Barnes & Noble took the book. And it ended up, they took the book. They still have it today. If you go in, it's been in there ever since. I don't know. I just, it makes me really proud that I had something to do with that great success. You know, personally, I put a lot of work and effort into it.
40 years in the publishing industry, and it's also in your blood, as you talk about in your family tradition. Explain.
Oh, in my blood, I have a long family history of publishers. So my great grandfather started a publishing company, used his own name, Doubleday, and it became the largest publisher in America before he died. He started it when he was in his early 30s. And his son, my grandfather, was a great publisher. And my father, on the other side of my family, my father ran one of the largest publishers in America for his career. So it's I'm the fourth generation. So I don't know. In the blood, it never seemed to be in my blood, you know. I didn't grow up in New York in publishing circles. So it never felt in my blood, you know, but certainly I have a strong connection to it, opened a lot of doors for me, and I've always been an incredible book lover.
Did you always know you were going to go into publishing, though?
No, hell no. I was going to be a marine biologist. I was, you know, through sort of the first half of, until I failed out of organic chemistry, I was determined to be a marine biologist. And then, you know, it just sort of, I fell into it, you know, it was something I explored because of the family connection. And once I started, I never wanted to leave.
Where'd you get your start?
I was a traveling salesman, in Seattle, Washington, because I couldn't get a job. I graduated from college at the end of the recession and couldn't get jobs. And finally went to a publishing course, and it was the first job that was offered me. So it was, you know, I needed a job, and I was willing to go anywhere in the United States to do it. And turned out I got an interview and I got a job offer to be a traveling college textbook salesman in Seattle, Washington. And it's a funny thing, you know, nobody dreams of being a college textbook salesman. They really don't. And it's a great job. And I had a ton of fun at it, but that's how I started.
And how'd you get from there to working on a children's book with the Duchess of York?
I'd like to say I was good at work early on, but I worked really hard, and I had a lot of luck, and I had some good people who, you know, looked after me as far as they liked the work I did and they tried to promote me. So I worked for my family company for 4 years. That didn't work out. So I left and I went to Simon. At the end of the day, I went to Macmillan, the old Macmillan, and then I went to Simon & Schuster. And, you know, at age 29, I was a division president. And, you know, the head of Simon & Schuster, Dick Snyder, did a deal with the Duchess of York at a dinner and sort of dumped it in my lap and said, here, you know, make it happen. It has to be 100% confidential. The Duchess, you know, wanted to do these kids' books featuring a little helicopter, Budgie the little helicopter. And There it was. It was a small division of people, and we were doing sort of, traditional children's books. And here was this big celebrity children's book, and it turned into quite a thing. She ended up keeping some of the royalty money that got in the press. The palace became it was at the height of her, when she was most infamous. It was when the press had really turned against her. And I had to go over to Buckingham Palace and deal with the press secretary of the Queen and figure out how to get her into the United States to do this book tour when they didn't want to. And the books were successful, and she was a ton of fun. I really liked her, and you got to see how tough it is for a young person coming into the royal family by marriage. Is really difficult. The Robin Janvrin, who's press secretary to the Queen, took me aside and he said, "John, what you have got to consider is the royal family is like a Fortune 500 company, but all the top executives are related and many of them are in-laws." And that's what it was like. It was really interesting.
And that was at a time when there weren't a lot of big celebrity children's books happening.
That's right. It
How did
was.
you deal with that?
I just, I tried to we tried to publish it like a sort of a combination of a celebrity book and a children's book. We sort of made it up as we went along, and she was the royal family at that point. Princess Diana was in the spotlight. Sarah Ferguson was considered, I don't know, the bad princess, as it were. And they're on the cover of People magazine, God, every other week. And so we tried to, we had a press conference when we announced the book at Paramount, which is the parent company. And there were 60 reporters in the room. That doesn't happen with books. So it was interesting. It was taxing. But we made it up as we went along, and at the end, we did a pretty good job of it. I think she would say we did a good job. I stayed friends with her for quite a while, and she would say we did a good job for her.
What makes a children's book successful? How did you know at first sight that Chicka Chicka Boom Boom was going to be a success and that Budgie the helicopter would sell?
It's impossible to tell. And I made several really bad calls. Rainbow Fish, I passed on. It's hard to tell. Chicka Chicka Boom Boom was the best children's books work on two levels. They work for the parent or the reader as well as for the child. And if you read Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, it reads like a song, and it's inventive. And I had a kid at the time, and I used to read it to my daughter all the time. And it's just a fantastic sort of experience. It's fun. Reading the book is really fun. And if you can get the magic of a purpose of the book, which is, teaching the ABCs, and make it really fun and different and magical. And we just felt, you feel it. It's instinctual. There's no, you can't learn it. It can't be taught. You have to. You open up and you feel it, and then as you have that experience over and over again, you become better at it.
And how did you go from children's books to the CEO of Macmillan 2 decades at Macmillan?
I first went I went to Dorling Kindersley, which is of bright white books with four color illustrations, family reference books. And I'd always wanted to be an adult sort of, fiction, nonfiction, adult trade book publisher. And the opportunity came up. I had done a good job. DK had grown from, I don't know, $14 million to almost $100 million in 3 years. So I'd done a good job, and I got called by the head of St. Martin's Press. He was retiring, and we had these three lunches at his desk. He had a tuna fish sandwich, and I had a chicken sandwich. He never mentioned a job. We just talked, and he called me a fourth time, and I said, "What are we just like having sandwiches and talking?" And he finally said, "Well, actually, I have a job offer for you." And offered me the job, and I stayed for, 24 years.
Take me to one day of those 24 years, January 8th, 2018, when you sent the employees of your company a letter that included these words, quote, "We will not allow any president to achieve by intimidation what our Constitution precludes him or her from achieving in court. As citizens, we must demand that President Trump understand and abide by the First Amendment of our Constitution."
Yeah, it was stunning. We had that was an amazing time. We had done a deal with Michael Wolff. He had gotten access into the for the first 100 days of the Trump administration, and he got to sit in the West Wing, and he would go in, and people would talk to him. Remember, it was chaotic, and they had all those different factions, and they all talked to Michael, and we ended up, it was to be a first 100 days book. It ended up being first 200 days. It came out and it leaked in the press. And the president, the White House released a statement, and the president sent us a legal letter demanding that we cease the publication of the book. And that is the, it's called prior restraint. It is the single, according to Supreme Court law, it is the single worst violation of the First Amendment you can do. If you are a government figure and the press has written something negative about you, you cannot try to stop it before it is published. A and B, the President of the United States is perceived to have the largest bully pulpit in the world, and in particular, the president can't do that. He has to take whatever grief the press gives him. So it's a big deal. We moved the publication forward. I wrote that letter, and it was released. He released his legal letter to us saying cease and desist immediately. I released that letter back, and we released the book early, and the White House protested. And I w when it first happened, I thought, boy, we're going to sell a ton of books. Yahoo, the president has made this a national issue. And then I started to think about it, and it's the first thing that happens when authoritarian governments come into power is they stop the press from talking about themselves in a negative way. And so here you had that in the United States of America. You had a president taking the first action that you would take if you were going to run an authoritarian government. And so, we took it very seriously. I tried to teach the staff and the people in our company, and to make a statement, across the country, that this was not okay, and it's not a small thing. It's completely unacceptable.
Did you know at the time that the words in that letter were going to be quoted in most every major American newspaper around the country the next day?
Yes, I wanted to write it in a way. I didn't think a press release was the right way to go. I wanted to be able to write it in my voice, with really trying to frame what the issue was specifically and why it was so important. So I wrote a letter to our employees, and in for that particular reason, to make sure that I could in my voice convey how important this was. I didn't
Although,
think it was a, I didn't think a sort of corporate press release was the way to go.
in your voice, you ended the first draft, at least, of that letter a little bit differently, correct?
Yeah, I thought I had this great line because it seemed to fit so well. And my last line was, "Mr. President, go fish." And I got done. I got done with it, and I proudly showed it to my wife, and she said to me straight right away. She said, "This is a little juvenile, John. You better think of a better response, a better way to close it than that."
You did end up selling a lot of books, though, after that
Oh
incident.
yeah. They were selling. It was, I don't know, I think 14,000 an hour on Amazon at one point. It sold an extraordinary number of books very, very fast.
To the point where you had to change the way books were printed, or at least the paper industry, how it worked together.
Oh yeah, we got the various manufacturers in the United States to work together. We got the paper manufacturers. I personally intervened with the guys running the paper companies. We got a printer in Europe to print the export editions. We did the printing. We got 1 million books printed in a week,
A lot of stories.
which is really, really hard to do.
A lot of stories in this book, "Turning Pages: The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher" by John Sargent. One more I want you to get to is how you ended up passing on going to a party at the Playboy Mansion with Salman Rushdie.
Yeah, I just I it's not a long story. I just passed. I was a great admirer of Salman when he went through what he went through, the publication of Satanic Verses and the years of having to essentially live in hiding, and how firm he was and how strong he was on First Amendment rights, and it was an inspiring time for those of us who are real believers in the First Amendment. And inspiring. And we were doing a book with him, and he came to ABA in Los Angeles, and he came into the booth and asked me to go with him to. He said, "Come on, I got a car. Let's go to the Playboy Mansion tonight." And I thought it through, and I was a young father, and I hadn't gotten a lot of sleep, and I thought, "Oh my God, someone's going to go there. I'm going to get out of there at 2:30 in the morning." And I had this big long list of meetings the next day, and I punted on it, and it's one of my regrets. That would have been a unique experience, certainly.
Again, a lot of stories in this book. A new book that's been published is about what you experienced firsthand over 40 years about the publishing industry. Emory University professor Dan Sinikin is out with the book Big Fiction: How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Have you read that book?
No, I haven't. I've been around long enough. I remember the days when everybody was saying color TV was going to ruin the publishing industry, right? There's this belief that sort of the sky is always falling in the publishing industry, and we go through these cycles, and there's problems, and we're going through a cycle now where there's problems. But people do love to read, and publishing is more conglomerate than it was. There are fewer publishers, and there are larger publishers, but at the same time, the self-publishing industry has exploded. All the barriers to entry for small publishers have come down. There's a tremendous amount of work being published across the board, and I'm hugely optimistic. I think at the end of the day, it'll be just fine. People will get to tell their stories in book form, and people will read those stories in book form. So I'm less pessimistic than a lot of people. Because I've seen time and time again people say, this is going to make publishing go away, or the death of publishing. It's been predicted frequently.
When was the biggest example of that over your 40-year career, that the sky was falling?
The biggest example was the digital transformation when Amazon popularized the reading of books on devices. And the price point came out at $9.99, and everybody thought publishing as we know it is going to be over. You had the music industry to look at, but there wasn't a music store left. It went from being sort of one in every town to none. And people saw bookstores were going to go that way, and there was a lot of fear in the industry, tons of fear in the industry, that the retail side of bookselling was going to go away, and it was all going to be on these devices. We weren't going to have books anymore.
Today, there's a lot of fear in the industry about what AI will do, whether AI is going to be publishing books on its own. What are your thoughts on that?
It'll depend on how the publishers today react to artificial intelligence and books, right? It will need to be copyright will need to be applied to AI, to the writing of AI. So if you take Nora Roberts and you take everyone, you have a computer read all her books and you say, generate for me a book that is a Western romance written by Nora Roberts, and the computer generates that. Nora Roberts needs to be paid. It's her work that created that. That computer is using her work. So it's going to have to, like when the digital transformation happened, there'll be another instance where publishers are going to have to get very proactive. There's going to be lawsuits. There's going to have to be Congress can probably have to be involved. We'll have to find a way to make sure. I, for one, don't want to be reading my books read by machines. It in its nature, the machine will read all the books that have been written and imitate them, right? And write like them, like somebody's style. When you have a one of these engines actually work on writing something, you ask it to write you something in the style of. Well, that's derivative, right? So I don't personally ever see wanting to read books written by machines. But we'll see. It's going to be interesting.
If you want to read about a career lived over 40 years in the publishing industry, John Sargent's book, Turning Pages: The Adventures and Misadventures of a Publisher. Thanks for talking about it on Book TV.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
And you're watching About Books, a program and podcast produced by C-SPAN's Book TV. Well, this week on our Afterwards program, it's an interview with cultural critic and film historian Peter Biskind. His new book is about the changes in the television industry over the past 40 years. It's entitled Pandora's Box. Here's a preview.
You know, the whole model is changing, and not for the good. I think it's a. The other thing is that, you know, because Netflix has not been as profitable, none of the streamers have been profitable as people thought they were going to be. They're changing the model, so they're inaugurating advertising-driven tiers, which are about half as expensive as ad-free tiers. And I think once you let advertisers in the door, they're going to try to impose the same limitations on programming as they imposed on the networks. So that seems to me a really a danger sign.
You think it's going to make the ad, having ads on streaming services is just inherently going to make people more, these programmers a lot more cautious and
Yes, exactly.
that's sobering.
And with networks, they just didn't want to be, advertisers sort of, from their point of view, justifiably didn't want to be adjacent to scenes, that were going to turn people off. And I think the same is true, are going to be true of streaming. Why should it be any different?
And Afterwards airs every Sunday evening on Book TV at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Well, thanks for joining us for About Books, a program and podcast produced by C-SPAN's Book TV. A reminder that Book TV will continue to bring you publishing news and author programs. This podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts or on the C-SPAN Now app. And you can watch all Book TV programs online anytime at booktv.org.